Today, I have a special guest, Rebecca Bender, and in this True Talk, which is really talking about the fight to end human trafficking, you guys are in for a treat. Let's just say that. I mean, she is a survivor, and this is part three of this three-part series of putting an end to human trafficking, but also we need to begin to understand, because when we understand and have knowledge, we can turn it into wisdom and we can begin to use our skills and our gifts and our talents and our abilities and our resources to continue to change the world. And I love the most basic, simplest, if that's a word, thing that she shared was it starts at home. It starts with how we raise our children. It starts with how we raise daughters and sons in this world of what it looks like to love, to be loved, and according to the word. Rebecca shares her story as a survivor. Now, if you haven't listened to part one or part two, part one is with Anthony from the organization, the nonprofit 611 Network. And I wanted to get a founder's point of view. And part two is with Nadia, who is the outreach director with 611, who talks about going on the streets. And there's nobody better than Rebecca being here with us today as a survivor to really shed light on this whole story from a survivor. I also want you to pay attention to the words that she uses so that we can be aware of the words that we use to other women. And I think that that is so important to honor somebody's pain and to not just assume, well, why didn't she just run away? Why didn't she just do that? But that we can listen and begin to understand their story. She has some amazing resources for you if you're not sure how to partake or join this movement. She has a link for you at rebeccabender.org to a quiz to take to find your lane. And she goes more into this. But let me just go ahead and stop talking here so that we can go ahead and get to the interview. Rebecca, thank you so much for being here with us today. I'm excited, one, for people to hear your story. I followed you for a while on the gram, so sometimes you feel like you know somebody, but I just loved watching your story. You share your story. You just released a book this year, and I would love for people, one, to just get to know you because you have a powerful story. Why don't we just start with your story? Start from the beginning and share as much or as little as you would like.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here. And thanks for opening, you know, our story up to and this topic up to all of your listeners and everyone that you engage with, your community. It's awesome. So my story, it's obviously a giant, long story, lots of twists and turns. So please go check out the book or get the Audible. You might have credits from online shopping. Get the Audible.
And say the title. Say the title.
Yeah, In Pursuit of Love by Rebecca Bender. And I read it myself, so you get to kind of hear the emotion through it, hopefully, both the good and the bad. But so it's a big story, but for time's sake, I was born and raised in a small town in Southern Oregon. I grew up, you know, skipping rocks on the river and riding my bike to my neighbors and just swim holes. I'm an Oregon girl, fourth generation Oregonian. So that's, you know, just a normal small town kid, normal kind of all-American classic. My dad worked at the local lumber mill. So just, you know, regular middle class blue collar family. My parents divorced when I was nine. It was a really ugly divorce, left a lot of vulnerabilities in me, feeling unwanted and unimportant and alone. My dad started drinking quite a bit. And so my, you know, visits with him were spent with him dropping me off somewhere else so that he could go to the bar. And he's doing great now. He's been sober a very long time. We have a great relationship. But I bring it up because I think even what appears like good kids from good homes, if you're looking from the outside, whether as a school or a friend or a neighbor, those did create some wounds in me. So even kids from normal homes still have vulnerabilities. And that continued when I ended up going off to college and I got pregnant and I, you know, gave back my dorm room. I hadn't moved in yet to go to community college and have my daughter. And that's when I met the most, what I thought was the most amazing guy. He was older and smart and funny and had all the solutions to my problems. And, you know, here I was with all these same vulnerabilities from a young girl. Now a young teen mom trying to figure out life. And here comes this guy with all the answers. And I know now that he targeted me because I was the girl on campus with the kid. And he got to know my hopes and dreams and just really pretended to be someone he was not in order to get me to fall in love. That's what con artists do. Mm-hmm. And he was no different. And he ended up, after 6 months of dating me, invited me to move in with him, where he took me to Las Vegas and forced me into human trafficking. So that's my story. I was trafficked for nearly 6 years, bought and sold between three different traffickers, branded twice, a horrible amount of abuse and trauma, bonded with other women in the home. So then it creates this very much like a cult family. And I can't wait to get into more of what we're doing today, but that's, I'll stop. So I'm sure that I see you writing down questions. We're gonna get into it.
I love, can you, when you say he forced you in, I think it's easy for somebody to say, well, didn't you have a choice at that point? What does it look like from that perspective of being, feeling like you're in love? Because we all probably know what that feeling is like, right? Mm-hmm. Of just, oh, this guy is, he really does care. We're going to Las Vegas. And what is, I mean, when you say forced, what does that look like so people can get an idea of the actual trauma that you had probably experienced and the manipulation and the sociopath and all of those things?
Yeah. I mean, traffickers are really good at pretending, at using Maslow's hierarchy of needs to traffic people. It's actually a book or an article written by a trafficker is called that. So I mean, that they have books out, they have forums where they're teaching each other manipulation tactics, control tactics, prison of war style brainwashing tactics, where you're replacing someone's ideologies with new ideologies. You're being rewarded for cooperation. You're being punished for non-cooperation. So it's very much a cult-like setting. And actually, the University of Northern Colorado did a big research report where they revealed that domestic human trafficking fits every single indicator of cult behavior. So the occult community and those that work in that type of crime have actual like 15 markers that they look for to identify if something is considered a potential cult. Human trafficking fits every single one. So you feel very brainwashed, but you don't think you're being brainwashed. And so there's this misconception to envision stranger danger and kidnapping. And just quite honestly, if you think of it as a business, which is what traffickers do, that's not a very sellable product. It's not. Oftentimes when we see kidnap situations, it's for personal sexual servitude, but it is not human trafficking. What makes it human trafficking is the exchange of monetary value to a third party. That makes it then legally become a trafficking case. So when we see people like the Amanda Berry situation, which was horrible. I mean, she was missing for over a decade. Horrible abuse, like unbelievable abuse. It wasn't trafficking though, because she was never sold to a third person. She was kidnapped for that criminal, that evil person's personal desires. And so I think what's been happening with this world of awareness with trafficking right now, which it's great because people are talking about it, but we're seeing everything, you know, marked trafficking by the general public. And that's just not true. And there's a real danger. You know, if your car has been robbed, we can't say like, they may have been looking for my address to go to my house and kidnap my, you're like, okay, calm down. Car robbery's fine. Like, let's not try to make everything so sensationally trafficking that we're missing. We're going to just look for the wrong thing. Cause right, how carjackers create predatory behavior is going to be very different than traffickers. And so we have to be wise as serpents to know what to look for and what, how to keep each other safe and how to keep our communities protected.
No, I'm glad that you mentioned that. Cause like you said, I think especially in this year of 2020, at the time of recording this, it's social media can get really blurry and there's a lot of information that people are just kind of following the leader.
Yeah.
Of the sharing. Now when you talked about the targeting and you kind of were that perfect person, I guess, to be targeted, you were a single mom. What are targeters thinking and looking for when it comes to picking up somebody to traffic?
Yeah, traffickers are looking for a vulnerability. You know, trafficking, it looks really different based on the community and culture in which you live. So what trafficking looks like in Brooklyn is going to look very different than it does in Greenville, than it does in Dallas, than it does in, you know, Manassas, Massachusetts, or Heber Springs, Arkansas, or Port Orchard, Washington. And trafficking is taking place everywhere. The exploitation of women and children exists everywhere, but it might look different based on your culture, your community, and where you live. And so regardless of that, though, traffickers are looking for vulnerable people. So if you close your eyes and envision who is the vulnerable people in my community, we have a huge homeless youth population where I live. We've got a lot of nonprofits that work. We have one called Joe's Place that makes food every single night, and homeless teens come and get free food and maybe get a sleeping bag. And so traffickers are probably hanging out there too. And they're looking for who's vulnerable, who's most at risk. That's just my one example of my community, but all of us have that. We all have a vulnerable people group in our community, and traffickers are looking for them. They're looking for single moms. They're looking for people in poverty. They're looking for those who might have a mental illness. They're looking for those that are the most marginalized. We see undocumented people targeted even more because traffickers know that they'll be too afraid to call the police, and so they're targeted by predators. And so we need to be thinking about who's marginalized in our communities.
No, that's good. I think I asked that question too, just to help us to understand, because I think when we have knowledge, then we can apply wisdom, and then we can open our eyes to look around to see, oh, this man came out of nowhere to talk to the single mom. And it's just awareness with that. And you being, like you said, to understand where you live, what are the vulnerabilities in your city? Now, you are older. Can you tell us your age of when you fell in love with this guy and being a single mom?
Yeah, I was 18, probably almost 19. I think I may have just turned 19 when we moved. You know, I just remember it being cold. And so in my mind, I'm like, was it December or January? That kind of makes the difference if you're 18 or 19. Potato, patata, some people might not care. But sometimes I've had people be like, but what about this? Does, you know, I'm like, lady, I don't remember if it was December or January. It makes a difference in year. I get it. But that's the thing with trauma, right? Is what we teach law enforcement today is that in order to interview someone who's been through trauma, you really have to tap in on senses, because the way our brains have been created is so cool. We go into protective modes. Our brains have like parasympathetic modes. We have trauma response brains. There's all these things that are really fascinating about neurology and trauma and its protective mechanisms. But what that does is it means that only the senses will unlock sometimes memories. So it's like, well, what did you smell? What was the feeling in the air? Did you remember hearing any sounds? When you start to have law enforcement learning the neurology and trauma and those type of interview techniques, it actually unlocks a ton of information. And so I love to see how science is evolving. We used to just say, yeah, if they can't remember, they're probably lying. And you're like, or not, or it might actually be a sign of trauma. And there's what's called Swiss cheese brain for a reason. And that term refers to pockets of memories not being there. And it's actually a way that our brain has learned to cope with really hard, hard things.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was not a child. I was 18, 19. I mean, obviously our brains still don't develop until they're 25, the prefrontal cortex. So your cause and effect isn't totally, that's why we all made bad decisions at 18 years old. And you know, I mean, honestly, there's a real risk. We hear different ages thrown around for who's most at risk for human trafficking. There's a stat out there right now that says the average age of entry is 12 to 14. No one can find any data that's citable from, where it's like we've all just been sharing this one thing for 10 years and no one really knows where it came from.
Yeah.
I would argue that if you look at the human trafficking hotline numbers annually, there's two groups of trafficking. There's familial trafficking and there's domestic pimp control. There's lots more. There's gang, there's cantinas, there's a lot. But when you're just looking at the average age specifically, oftentimes there's this group of 16 to 24 year olds that are highly at risk because sex sells in our country. That's the truth. And then there's this other group of about 5 to 12 of people who are being exploited oftentimes by a family member or someone close to them, by perpetrators that are pedophilic in nature that want to create child abuse images, also used to be known as child porn. It's kind of an outdated term. In the legal community. And so there's kind of these two different groups. Now, are they both trafficking? If money's exchanged, they are. Are they both exploitation? Yes. And so I think it's just really important that we're not lumping both of those categories together, because familial trafficking might be very different for a neighbor or a teacher or a child welfare worker to look for than a 17, 18, 19-year-old being targeted for a vulnerability. Both happen, both are vulnerable, both take place. It's just different predatory tactics, and we just need to be wise.
No, that's good. I asked you your age because I think you just addressed everything I was going to want to get into is we think it's just the younger kids. They're, you're going to college, you know, single mom. It's not going to happen to her because, well, she's older, you know, and she's out of high school. And I think it was really powerful for you to share that part because, again, awareness, understanding, instead of just following the leader of what you hear, but hearing, I just saw a post also on Instagram that you posted about all the survivor books. It's like you said, read our story so that you can understand basically the history and get to know us. What I love that I want to go back to the police talk was I was reading a book called Girls Like Us. And
by Rachel Lloyd.
Yeah. And she was talking about really how the police sometimes think it's their choice. So like if they're a prostitute or working in a strip club and they come in, she would say how hard it is for the women to get help because they're just choosing to be prostitutes. Do you want to speak into that? Because I know in one of your Mythbusters that you talked about, well, it's like we choose this life. Like this is a life that you're choosing. Can you speak to that and the truth to that?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And I think a couple things. I feel like my mind just went to like three different things. I tried to take notes real quick. You see me looking down, I'm taking notes. I'm not on my phone. But you know, one of the things I think is so important is that, yes, even what you said before that question was, you know, well, she's older, well, she's off at college, she should know better. Here's the thing, as survivors of trafficking, as people, even the ones that are currently being victimized, we grew up in the same culture as you. So we watched the same movies that you watched. We listened to the same, you know, news articles. And so we too, our whole lives have pictured human trafficking as kidnapped children in foreign countries. And so when my particular relationship, quote unquote, is becoming, maybe my boundaries are starting to be pushed. He's starting to intimidate me with his presence. He's starting to make slow demands. He's starting to pressure me to do things that I'm not comfortable doing. It's those little tiny subtleties that you think, well, I'm not being kidnapped. Well, trafficking only happens to kids overseas. And so the sensationalism is actually fueling misidentification, not just in people in our communities, but it's fueling it in us. So we're not as victims asking for help because we think, well, I wasn't kidnapped and like smuggled into Thailand. So I must not be being trafficked, right?
And keep thinking of the movie Taken.
Yes, like, I just picture these one sensational Hollywood scene, and it's just very, very rarely, if ever, how it really looks in your own community. And so I think it's not just about us raising awareness for the people around us, but it's also for the victims, right? Like you have people in your life right now that are picturing trafficking that way, and that means if their boyfriend starts pressuring them to do something they're not comfortable with, will they tell anyone? Or have we only taught them to sound the alarm when it's stranger danger? And I think this is a big point of what's happening in our world with the Epstein case right now. I mean, think of that. Those girls went home to their parents every single day for dinner. They went to school every single day and nobody noticed. And those girls never asked for help because we're telling everybody that trafficking is only kidnapped kids overseas. And here then we have all these people that are being exploited and pressured and boundaries pushed little by little. Those are the things we want to start talking to our kids about. When your boundaries start getting pushed, what does that look like? What are people doing when they're testing your boundaries to see if you will tell, if you will back off, if you will scream for no by just putting a hand on a leg? Do you tell your kids to watch for that and not just inappropriate? You know, people that are targeting your kids online, those people are starting by asking for normal photos. And they're acting like another child of the similar age and gender. And so it's like, hey, send me your school photo. Because they want to see if they've been taught. It's a very tiny little worm they're putting out as bait to see if it's being taken. We have to teach our kids better for those brainwashing, those influencing, those boundaries being pushed. Those are the things that I think we're missing as a community to teach our kids. We're only warning them of stranger danger. And by then it's too late.
Mm-hmm. That's good. I think about just even the trauma of my own past of just growing up in an abusive home. But when you're vulnerable and you're looking for love, a hand on the leg, though, doesn't seem, you know, as anything obscure. Do you know? Because you're looking for that attention.
You're wanting, and that's where we see people get really confused as like, but as a kid, I didn't want it. And yet something made me feel like I was special for the first time. And so it becomes, that's where you get a lot of trauma from, is it's really confusing in your brain. And even not as kids, even as adults, right? It's like, this is why domestic violence is still prevalent today, is because there's this moment where you think it's going to end. You hope it's going to change. You don't want to let go of this relationship and these ideals that you've created around a relationship. And it's really hard to navigate this whole new world of escape, especially the longer you've been with an abuser. It's so hard to navigate where you're going to live and what car you're going to drive and how you'll feed your kids if they're financially 100% supporting you. There's just so many layers and complexities. I think that's what we're seeing with trafficking, especially in people that are, you know, maybe 18 to 24, is you're seeing some of those similarities to domestic violence because the victim themselves thinks that they're in a loving relationship. But, you know, it goes back to choice, right? It goes back to the question, or the statement rather, that I've heard. I think I originally, the person who said it was Exodus Cry, but, you know, it's been passed around for so long. But the quote is, prostitution is the choice of the choiceless. You know, prostitution is people who don't have a lot of options, who don't have a lot of education, don't have a lot of opportunity, may have been desensitized to abuse or hypersexualization as children, so they think this is normal, don't have good support groups or communities, big portion coming out of foster care of those. And there's always going to be that 2% that's like, nope, I am a Stanford graduate and I came from a very well-to-do family that gave me a ton of opportunities and I still chose Great, that's the 2%, 1%. We shouldn't be making broad sweeping stereotypes or laws based on a very, very small percentage.
Yeah, I think, well, when you talk to women, you know, survivors and stuff, would they ever, I mean, your percentage, would, if you went up to them and say, did you choose this, would their answer majority be no?
Here's the funny thing. This is actually another study that's being done right now by a research center called the Avery Center. And if you go and ask trafficked victims today who are survivors, who are out of it, who are living, you know, healthy, thriving lives, they have a certain number of years after escaping. So not like the day after escape. I mean, a certain amount of time to heal and separate and distance themselves. If you ask, would you have called yourself a sex worker while you were being trafficked? All of them say yes. Yep, I thought I wanted to be there. He had me brainwashed and convinced that I wanted to be here. That's the problem. It feels in the moment like your choice. And there's a part in my book where I actually share this brief moment on Halloween when there's these all these girls that have flown into Vegas for Vegas in Halloween, and they're dressed up very, very provocatively, like street walkers, like Pretty Woman type of attire. And as they're walking, I can remember my trafficker slowly driving by them and pointing at them and saying, do you see those girls? They wish they could be you. You get to be that brave every day. You're brave. You're courageous. They want to be you. You know what that feels like for an 18-year-old girl who has felt alone, unwanted, and unimportant? It's that moment where you feel this false sense of empowerment that you take because you're starving. That's what this is. Like, trafficking is traffickers being predatory and manipulative, and they know what to say, and they find your vulnerability and they exploit it. And so it's very rarely kidnapped. Actually, according to FBI, less than 1% of trafficked victims are kidnapped. Most people are exploited by somebody that they know and trust.
Yeah.
So choice is really subjective to people's options and opportunities and childhood experiences. I think there's a lot more layers that we don't think through before we just go, oh, those girls want to be there. And here's one other thing I'll share. You talk about strip clubs. I can remember anytime my trafficker would take us to a new city, he would start us in a strip club because that's where you can instantly get some regulars and know they're not cops. So it's a tactic. So you see girls in the strip club and you have no clue that there may be a handful there that who the trafficker is actually sitting outside in the parking lot and she's there to get new clients because she's new in town. It happens. And anytime there's an opportunity to make money, corruption will follow. It's just that simple. You know, this is why prescription drugs have drug dealers. This is why there's fraud within pharmaceuticals. This is why, like, anywhere there's an opportunity to make money, we're naive to think that there's not corruption in a sex industry. Like, get out of here. There are definitely traffickers that are exploiting people in strip clubs, that are targeting those types of individuals. you know, I mean, that would be the first place that traffickers also look to find new victims. Not the first place, but I can remember one of my traffickers went into a strip club and would go around and try to meet the girls. Because think of it, if her boundaries are already pushed out that far, it doesn't take a lot more. Is it harder to convince and recruit and brainwash and trick and defraud a girl that's about to graduate high school, that's the varsity cheerleader and has a really affluent family? Or is it easier to convince the 18-year-old girl that just started at the strip club? Which one? It's about how much time and energy am I going to put in for my outcome of money, right? It's a business, and we are smarter than traffickers. We can be. And if we know, if we can see, oh, they think of this like a business, what's a sellable product and what's my least path of resistance?
Yeah.
That shows you who's at risk.
That's a beautiful example of what you don't know, you don't know. And I like to say a lot that we have to relearn what love is, especially according to scripture, because a love for a lot of people is manipulation. It is abuse. It looks like not kind words. It looks like, or it could be kind words in the form of manipulation, like you just shared.
Yeah.
And I think relearning what love is, and in those decisions, it's so true. When you said that, I was like, oh yeah, I can remember this guy or this guy. I was like, I thought it was okay. And I thought it was good. And, and everything like that. I know we're running out of time, but I want us to really answer this question that I don't want to say get irritated with, but how you just didn't run away. You know, you were in you're being trafficked for so long. Why didn't you just run away, Rebecca?
Yeah. And people ask this a lot. Why don't you just run? And I'm always like, why don't you just grab a grenade, bomb the Bellagio, jump out the window and run for freedom? And you're like, okay, that's a great movie scene if you're Angelina Jolie. But like, the real world isn't like the movies. And why didn't I run? I did. That's why I'm standing here. I did run. Why didn't I run sooner? Well, I had multiple attempted escapes. I learned what to do with every attempt. I learned where to hide a pair of jeans for next time. I learned post 9/11 that you can't buy plane tickets with cash, because I got all the way to the airport and they wouldn't sell me a ticket. My trafficker didn't leave me a debit card. One attempt, I got all the way home and my trafficker showed up in my tiny little farm town. And I can remember thinking, just don't hurt anybody. Don't cause a scene. I haven't told anyone. Yeah. And so, you know, why don't you just run? It's like, I tried and I did, and it's just not quite that simple. And there's also so much trauma bonding with not only your trafficker, and sometimes they call it capture bonding, or Stockholm syndrome is another term most people have heard of. But there's also a lot of bonds with the other people in the home. And the trafficker, I think, does that intentionally. It's like he plays this weird game where he pits you against each other, but he also lets you feel like this is the family that maybe you've never had, or your child has never had. And I can remember having moments thinking, but if I run, what about her? Like, I can't leave my friend. And so it's way more complex psychologically than people realize. And I can remember running for good. The final time that I ran for good, I remember making this decision of like, I'm never going to see these women that for the last multiple years had become my very best friends. I have no clue what's going to happen to them. I don't know if he's going to beat them because they didn't watch me good enough. I don't know what punishment is going to await them if I run. And at some point, as you well know, like it gets like it, unfortunately, as much as I love them, I have to put me and my kid first. But those are hard as women in general, as God made us, looking out for one another, being protective of other children. That is still in you, even as a trafficked victim. And so it's just hard to explain to people the brainwash. And also the reality is that, you know, you've lived in so much trauma, you actually start to feel your sanity slipping away a little bit. Or I can remember feeling like I'm going crazy. Like, I think there's cameras in my house. I've never thought like this in my life. I thought maybe he had bugged my phone because he tended to know everything that was going on. I remember banging my head on the floor once to just try to like wake up from it's the hardest feeling to explain to someone, the feeling that your sanity is slipping away from you. And so it's really hard to make healthy adult, healthy brain decisions. You know, and people are like, why didn't you run? I'm like, well, you're asking that from a really healthy adult brain. I wasn't. I had a traumatized 19, 20, 25-year-old brain at that point. And towards the end, I mean, it'd been so much trauma by then. And so I'm just grateful that God renews our mind, gives us a spirit of power, love, and sound mind, and he will renew our minds in Christ and all the things that we say, but took a lot of work to really implement into my healing. And it took a lot of time to really change the neural pathways of my thought life to make it more align with the word and not what my past used to say or what my trafficker used to say. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work.
Yeah. I wanted you to answer that question to also bring awareness to people so that they also know what to say and how to, because we all carry around pain and we know triggers, and that can be a trigger, that statement, because it's just like, oh my gosh, like I wanted to, trust me, like you want to probably like take them by the shoulders and be like, I wanted to, right? And I think it's just to be careful what we say to people that have been through certain things. Yeah. I had more to ask, but I do want to end on just a happy note, like
okay,
where you are now and you have amazing children. You've been married for, is it 10 years? I think I
11.
Saw it. 11 years on Instagram. Just tell us where you are now as a survivor and the hope you have for the future.
Yeah, thank you. Well, you know, one of the things I love to say too is that we are so much more than our stories. All of us are. We are more than one bad thing that happened to us years ago. You're more, I'm more, the people listening are more. You think of the worst experience of your life, you're more than that one moment. You know, you have dreams and gifts and skill sets and purpose and a call. And so I just love reminding people that you're more than your story. And you know, today I'm really grateful that I get to work as a leading subject matter expert on this topic, which means we have a nonprofit. It's called Elevate Academy. We mentor survivors on how to find their now what after not only escape, but possibly after you graduate from a program. I think we have this misconception that we're going to give survivors, I always make this joke, like Jesus and their GED, and somehow it all magically comes together. And it doesn't totally work like that. It's like you get out of a program, and there's still that moment of, but now what? Am I just going to work a minimum wage job the rest of my life? This doesn't really feel hopeful. And so we help survivors navigate their now what. We've had 777 women go through our online school in 9 countries, 368 U.S. cities. We've had survivors go through the program. So that's really awesome. But I started doing that work because I, too, just like any advocate starting out in the fight against human trafficking, I didn't really know my lane. And so I tried it all. I went on crisis calls. I helped girls escape. I showed up with cops at a hotel rooms in middle of the night. I've talked to teenage girls to try to convince them to leave their trafficker. I've done street outreach where I've been chased off by pimps and jumped in cars to get away from them by trying to do outreach to their girls. I have worked in shelters. I've written curriculum for shelters. I tried it all. I've helped assisted on policy. We passed Senate Bill 673 in the state of Oregon in 2014. I've testified in a variety of places in order to change laws. And, you know, we do some consulting work with demand. I mean, like literally, I tried every lane because I didn't know where I fit. And that's one thing I just love to leave your listeners with. We have an incredible Find Your Lane quiz and online course that's completely free. We just want to give you tools to help you find your lane. It's a personality profile, kind of like, you know, what Disney princess are you? So it's meant to be kind of lighthearted and fun and interactive. This is a serious topic, but we wanted to use humor to make it palatable. We wanted people to see that you can actually break this up into 9 easy bite-sized chunks and then just Marie Kondo it, right? Just be like, does crisis response give me joy? No. Next lane. And sometimes I think people try one thing and then they think, oh, I tried fighting trafficking. It's not for me. But if it's still something that really tugs at your heart, there's something all of us can do. And maybe you're just trying you're trying out a lane that's maybe not where your gift set is. So we want to help people see all the different ways. And I did it. I know it because I did it myself too. And now we work with law enforcement as our main goals. We mentor survivors and we work with law enforcement and create tools for the public to help them get more educated on this issue. And I've gotten educated myself from working with law enforcement so much and actually testifying at trials. I literally take the stand as, you know, like a blood splatter expert. I take the stand as a human trafficking expert and testify at trials all over the country. So I've learned a lot into like, well, what's legally trafficking and what's not. And It doesn't mean it's all not a horrible, but it's not all trafficking. And so we just need to be careful. And I think taking some of that and then turning it around into layman's terms and help trying to train like the general public. So you don't have to get into the legal minutia, but you know, how do we want to make sure that we're identifying what's really exploitation and what's not, because we can then better protect our kids.
What's the link for that quiz?
If you go to our website, it pops right up on our website, rebeccabender.org. The Find Your Lane quiz is in the toolbar. It pops right up as an option. So there's lots of Find Your Lane stuff on there to find if you poke around on the website. But yeah, a book come out this year, and I've been married 11 years, and I just finished my master's last year in biblical studies from Bethel Seminary. So I really loved that. And we have 4 daughters now. My oldest is 21. She's when I was with me when I was trafficked. And then I have 3 littles, 6, 8, and 10, and all girls.
So your husband's outnumbered.
Jesus help us all. But you know, one of the last things too I would want to share is that there might be some moms on here listening in that have sons, and they might think, you know, I'm not as at risk because I have boys. I'm raising boys, and I would encourage you to know there's always boys at risk for being exploited in some capacity. But the number one buyer of sex in the world, whether you're buying a child that's a boy or a girl, the number one buyer is American men. So if you want to talk about fighting trafficking, you raise good sons. That's how you fight trafficking. Mm-hmm. That's how you fight the demand. No demand, no business. That's a term that we've heard in the movement for many, many years. No buyers, no business, right? Yeah. And so if we can end the demand for young people for sale, we can end the demand of sex for sale. We can end this issue. How do we do that? We raise better sons. We raise sons in a really hypersexual culture that have strengthened character, have self-control, and wanting to stand up and protect and defend. That's what we can do. That's a place that we all could start. You don't have to jump into the lane of becoming this advocate, but we can start with figuring out how to raise our sons in a really hypersexual world.
It's so good. You're just saying it starts with us. It starts at home, you know, and Rebecca, like I said, I have so much I want to share, but thank you for everything that you've talked about today. I know one, it's going to bless, encourage, but also inform. And that's really what we need right now. We need to be, we need to find our lane, especially if we're called to it. And I think a lot of people, it's either I can't be on the streets or I can't give money. So, well, what can I do? And
right.
I love that we're keep talking about this. Well, there's so many different things that you can do. So thank you again.
So good.
Thank you again, Rebecca, for your time.
Thank you. This was awesome. And thanks for even shining a light on this issue. I know we've had a lot of incredible guests on to talk about this too. And I'm just honored to be a part.
P.S. One more thing. If you've ever felt like you weren't good enough, smart enough, pretty enough, thin enough, strong enough, worthy enough, or doing enough, then my best-selling book, Know Your Worth, is for you. If you knew what you were worth, would you settle for anything less? It's not uncommon to feel inadequate, whether it's issues surrounding your career, your body, relationships, or your finances. You will discover gems to apply in your own life as I take you through my own journey of how I was able to overcome the unthinkable by realizing my worth wasn't tied in the things or people, but to God. In this book, I really walk you through the how-to of stop settling for relationships that do nothing but cause you pain. Find the tools you need to be successful in life. Realize you are beautiful just the way you are. Refuse to settle for anything less than what's God's best for your life. And recognize that no matter what your past looks like, it doesn't have to be your future.